Hello, and welcome to the No Good Poetry Podcast. Each week, we talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly of poetry. This is episode 8
with
Joseph Bienvenu and
Joseph Makos.
This is the good, bad, and the ugly, isn't it? Some ugly shit out there, kids. Let's make the world safer for poetry.
This week's episode is going to be on visual poetry and sort of a primer to get people through understanding how to access sort of this, you know, relatively obscure genre if you really think about poetry and what we've got going here.
So we're going to bring to you today what maybe was previously impossible, which is a podcast on visual poetry.
I mean, it does seem a little strange, but I think we're going to make it work. This would definitely be an episode where I'd really suggest going to the show notes and following some of these links. It'll make a whole hell of a lot more sense if you do.
Sure, there's going to be a lot of active links on there that are going to take you to some sites, some compendiums of visual work, along with some of our guest's poetry that he's working on now and some of his greatest hits, and just, you know, some work for you to look at and to take in as you're listening to the podcast.
And so, yeah, so the first thing we're really going to do today, earlier, Joseph interviewed Derek, Bellio, I was so close. And do you want to tell everybody a little bit about Derek?
Sure, yeah, Derek, I discovered Derek's work through UbuWeb, actually, or just online. Was one of the beautiful things about the poetry world, actually the visual poetry world, is that it's a very hearty, interactive online forum, because that's what, I guess, basically what people have, you know, from sort of like the safety of their homes, interacting with people through the visual work. And it seems like there's a really interesting community around the visual poetry. So a few years ago, I was really kind of blown away by his interpretation of Flatland, which is like a visual score, visual interpretation, sort of charting the language of this Edwin Abbott Victorian era novel called Flatland, which some of you may have read in high school or may have taken a look at in high school.
I don't think anyone reads that in high school.
No one reads Flatland. I think we did in high school. We
read Maybe Flatland. In college.
Maybe in college. Okay. Yeah. And we, you know, basically started corresponding and just talking and sharing work. And I did this, you know, little beautiful handmade book for him. And, you know, and then I think after I even started working on that with him, I realized that he was the curator of UbuWeb's visual poetics section. So he curates that, and we're going to put a link to that and have a little access to some of that stuff. And really, the UbuWeb galleries of visual poetry, just click on something, you know? It's like you don't even really need to know anything about anything. Just go in there and find a name that you think is cool and just click on it.
In addition to the visual poetry, we're probably going to revisit UbuWeb later for some of the other great materials.
Ethnopoetics, sound poetry, there's a lot of good stuff. We'll come back with some more episodes.
But today we're talking about visual poetry, and I guess, so we're gonna let you go to that interview, but if you were going to have to tell, maybe some people in the audience don't know what we're talking about when we're saying visual poetry. What kind of things does that entail? I mean, it's a lot of things is part of the hard thing about defining it, I guess.
Well, that's a good question, because I think that, you know, Derek hits on an interesting point that poetry is already marginalized. And so visual poetry, I believe, comes again through another even more marginalized world. But I think visual poetry can be looked at as concrete poetry, which is a fixed attempt at putting language on the page in a intermedia-like way that can be, you know, non-representational language. So it can be read, it can be viewed, but it is indeterminate in that it can be interpreted in many different ways. So it's sort of where language and letter forms and words cross over into the visual art world. I see visual poetry as a footbridge.
A good way of thinking of it, yeah, because there's a lot of different ways that I think that can be done. And I think you're right, sometimes it is that sort of concrete use of language. and we can talk about that a little bit later too. But I think I'm stealing this from someone that I heard say it, but I can't remember who it was, so I apologize.
Steal away.
But I think normal poetry is about reading. Visual poetry is about thinking. Right? You're not reading so much as...
Or viewing.
Well, viewing... But not just viewing, right? You have to, it's about your reaction to it directly. I guess if you're reacting to poetry well, regular poetry is about that too, but visual poetry kind of forces it to be about thinking rather than just reading.
Sure. Well, a lot of, I think the most accessible but a lot of visual poetry comes through in the avant-garde in a way too that the Dadas really broke down. The Dadas and the Surrealists really...
Okay,
let's let
Derek talk first. Right. We're going to talk to...
Just shut me up.
You're
and
trying
let Derek.
To jump to the...
Sorry.
Jump ahead. All yeah, right. I think we...
So here we go. Here's our interview with Derek.
Hello, Derek.
Yes, hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, how are you?
What would you tell a young person who's kind of like coming out of their world of poetry, basically as a guide to stepping into that world?
Well, I think that Ubu Web is, in fact, an inexhaustible and incredibly important resource. You know, what Kenneth Goldsmith has created there is, you know, a repository. It's a tickle trunk of awesome. You know, like everything that you're looking for in terms of the avant-garde is there. I was very, very lucky and happy to help when he invited me to edit the visual poetry section and build on some of the early work that he had done there. I think that any emerging poet that is looking to expand their horizons and build on the work that they already know by looking into visual poetry or graphic score things can definitely benefit by looking at the Ubu Web Depository. I would suggest, you know, if people find this scary, if they find this this genre shocking or hard to access, I would suggest that they actually look back and take some comfort into some of the books that they have read often as kids. You know, whether it be something as approachable as Alice in Wonderland, and writing Alice in Wonderland is a visual poem, the Tale of the Mouse. Or, you know, look at something like Dr. Seuss's On Beyond Zebra that suggests an alphabet of 26 characters that takes place after the letter Z. And I think that, like, these are areas for play and for exploration, and they don't need to be frightening. They're actually very approachable, very reasonable, very playful space for poetry that has a long, long history. This isn't something that's just come up in the last few years.
Sure. Somebody I know who was doing some, you know, some quote-unquote visual avant-garde work, I reminded them that cave painting is 20,000 years old. So there's, you know, there's visual poetry, essentially, I guess, goes back to, you know, cave painting, right? I mean...
Sure, absolutely. Dick Higgins, the incredibly important intermedia artist and editor at Something Else Press, put out an anthology a couple decades ago called Pattern Poetry, Guide to an Unknown Literature. And this book basically tracks the history of visual poetry back through the eons through cave paintings, also looking at, Egyptian hieroglyphs, and Greek engravings and graffiti, all the way up to the present. This is a genre of poetry, a subgenre of poetry, with as rich a history as a more traditional lyric.
Right, and I think maybe it's overlooked by people sometimes. At least I think because. A lot is being, it's very indeterminate, and it's left to the eye, it's sort of beauty is in the eye of the beholder, you know?
Yeah, I think there's a few reasons why we don't spend a lot of time with visual poetry, and I think that one of the reasons is that we don't spend a lot of time with poetry, you know, like just there. I think that in a lot of cases we've been taught, you know, our high school instructors have taught us that poetry is something either... incredibly frightening and difficult, or intensely boring, and not boring in the fun way, but boring as in the dull and uninteresting way. And so we've been taught to stay away from poetry. It's either, you know, flippant and useless, or it's dull and boring. And what that's done is it hasn't promoted us being curious readers and curious people looking into this genre. This is a scary form. So I think that poetry as a whole is marginalized. I think, you know, being a poet at all is a radically strange act. Now, this is the, you know, but visual poetry is, you know, this is definitely on the fringes. But when I talk to my students about visual poetry, when I talk to them about concrete and sound poetry, these kind of forms, if I don't talk about it in terms of a history of poetry, if I look at it in terms of all the other ways that they understand of looking at their visual world, so whether it be icons on their desktop or on their cell phones, or, you know, those kind of images, or whether it be the design and musicality of video games, or logos that they find on street signs, or disintegrating graffiti that they find on train stations. If I ask them to start looking at that and what draws their eye to that type of writing, they understand immediately. Absolutely. They know how to read. They know how to read differently. But once you start encasing it within the word poetry, it becomes frightening and alien, and that they start feeling like they are ill-equipped. So I think we're doing them a disservice.
Sure. I was just at a gallery the other day for an art show and was looking at the work, and, you know, straight up, I realized that, you know, there's someone who is straight up doing visual poetry, but was not presented as such, as that. It was just sort of presented as this abstract, you know, visual multi-process print work that had, you know, some just language that was dropping off in the back, but definitely typographic in a certain way. One thing that I've always looked at is that I think the place that I believe that visual poetry comes across most is definitely in typography and in typographic work and graphic design, specifically typography work. Designers and graphic designers like to incorporate, you know, very playful use of words, letters, and language in the typographic presentation a lot these days. I don't think you can go through, you know, the public world and not see it, like, on a regular basis, like every day, almost everywhere.
Absolutely. You know, typographic design and graphic design has trained us to be able to read writing text as something plastic, as something that can be read in multiple directions, that can shift from sound to meaning, that can move and shake and twist across a screen. We are ready and able to read in that way. We already understand how to do that. It's when we start shifting it from looking at a text, you know, something like an ad, and moving it over to reading and moving it over to poetry, that's where we start frightening our students and frightening our readers. But you're right, you know, when you see text being engaged with in the gallery setting, often you can categorize that quite well as working within a history of visual poetry. I think that what holds that back in some cases is that, at least in my experience, poets don't have a whole lot of experience engaging with scale, engaging with something that's bigger than a page.
Wow,
so something,
yeah,
that is, yeah, wall-sized or painting-sized, right? They don't think big. And because we don't have a lot of experience engaging with poetry or engaging with reading that takes place on a larger scale within a gallery setting, we know how to read billboards. We're unsure what to do with that. A friend of mine, the Canadian and now living in Australia, poet Christian Book, He jokes that the reason why text art doesn't work in a gallery is that people don't like to read standing up.
Huh.
Right? We see reading as something that takes place on the page instead of taking place in a gallery setting. And so we have to start shifting our ideas between reading and looking. And that's maybe the space of difference or discomfort for visual poetry, is that it keeps moving us back and forward, back and forth between reading and looking. I know how to look at this in terms of a painting, but I don't know how to read it. Or I know how to read it, but what do you mean just look at it? You know, those kind of uncomfortable differences.
Sure. I feel as though my personal approach to visual poetry actually came through Olson, and not so much as saying that, like, we know that Olson is not a visual poet, but if you really flip through the Maximus poems, you know, his, like, constellated sort of projected verse, so to speak, it really does take it. What it did for me is it destroyed the boundaries of margin, and it destroyed the boundaries of left align.
Sure, absolutely. I think that Olson does suggest some very useful ideas in projective verse, for instance, and that idea of using the typewriter as the stave and bar of musical composition, right? That now suddenly poets can control or graph out breath and the length of a line and how we actually speak it, how you graph out how long this should take by looking at the fixed point of a typewriter and using that as a map. Now, and I think that's very useful, and I think that Olson, for instance, moving and engaging with this, the entire field of the page, just like Mallarmé, is incredibly useful and did open up a lot of spaces that I think a lot of poets still aren't quite sure. Like, this is a space for exploration still. The problem I have with Olson is that he foregrounds, in my opinion, he foregrounds speech. So poetry to him, like moving across the page, is still graphing it for performance. Poetry is still meant to be something that is spoken, that is performed, and he uses the page to graph out how long it should take and in what volume and at what pace. Now, I don't look at my visual poetry or a great deal of visual poetry as performable. So I don't look at visual poetry as something like, how long will this take to speak, and how am I engaging with the page as a performative score, which is something that I think Olson is trying to do in his writing.
Sure. But I still like his encouragements, you know, his encouragements that sort of, for me, they open up a new door, you know, into that world.
Yeah, absolutely.
Exploratory world. One thing I want to talk about a little bit is your work, in that you've taken this idea and concept of what you've done, but
mm-hmm.
you know, you've really taken this work and you've taken it into public spaces and public art, and you know, you've taken it into art installations and art pieces and saleable art, and commodified it in a specific way. This is like encouraging
mm-hmm.
that you've sort of done this. And where do you think all that sort of came from or started, or how has the interest sort of come through? Just about that, can you tell us a little bit?
Well, I like the idea of a moving text from form to form and seeing if it changes how we understand it. So if I take a visual poem and blow it up, you know, till 10 feet wide and plaster it on the side of a brick building, how do we approach that? How do we read at that scale? Or if I take the same piece and shrink it down until it's the size of a half-inch button and have it sitting on my lapel, they start working in different ways. When it's at the smaller scale, we start seeing it as a logo or as a promotional button for some sort of strange product that we're not aware of. And when we see it larger, it seems to work in these kind of, to me, these almost like dreamlike billboards, that we know it's trying to tell us something, but we just can't quite put our finger on it. And I like the fact that poetry, to me, to be really engaged today, should be able to be pourable from form to form. right? It can exist on a page, fine, and a gallery wall, and a t-shirt, and a button, and the front of your ball cap, and, you know, move it around and allow it to start doing things in unexpected ways. So long as it's on the page, so long as it's safely ensconced and, you know, cocooned inside of a book of poetry, to me, what that does is say, it tells the reader, ignore me. I am a inoffensive little poem. I stay on the bookshelf in this section that you don't need to read, and it keeps it over there. By moving it off into these other spaces, buttons and t-shirts and billboards and that kind of thing, it starts to confront us in different ways and starts to expect different forms of reading. And allowing it to interact with a reader in ways that I can't expect. So that's why I've been pouring my work from container to container, but also allowing it to be online for free to see what kind of response it generates that I wouldn't even expect. And I think that to me is the excitement in poetry, is the sharing of these little moments to see what the reader does in response. I think of somebody like the Canadian poet Margaret Avison in the 60s argued that the best response to a poem is another poem. I'm like, okay, now that's intriguing. So if I give you a poem that you like, you know, whether it be a billboard or a button, how do you talk back? What dialogues can we start going? So how does this start generating conversation? Huh. And that's where I'm excited.
Yeah, and I like, I appreciate and I'm inspired by the fact that you do that, mainly because I do think that there has been a strategic co-opting of visual poetry in the worlds of advertising. And I sort of think that you're reclaiming that for your work, and that idea of pouring into the other, because doesn't visual poetry that is used in advertising demand action?
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know that advertising co-opt visual poetry. I think that they're two heads on a single body. Visual poetry kind of comes to the fore in the 20th century at the same time as the newspaper starts really engaging with different forms of layout and design. So, you know, Dada work and constructivist work is straight out of the pages of the newspaper.
True.
And, you know, even McLuhan says to engage with the front page in the newspaper is to engage with cubism in the everyday, because you're having to read different points of view in different articles, all laid out on the same plane, and read and start to read for depth, you know, from page A1 to A6 and back to B5, and, you know, back and forth, that these start being alternate forms of reading. Poetry is just, visual poetry is just engaging with that same stuff in a different form. What has made the newspaper so vital is that it has stayed within the public discourse. Poetry has to.
Sure.
And so it's the poor cousin.
Huh. It's the poor, I like that. It's the poor cousin. So, you know, just say there's a young person coming into this genre or seeing it or, you know, wanting something a little more, or maybe not knowing necessarily where to step. Could you give some suggestions as to what maybe a young person might check out?
To me, it's in a Canadian setting, one of the, I would say, the go-to poet, the person whose work is most generative, most open, and most generous, because it basically promotes you to write back, because it presents all these different forms, is the Canadian poet B.P. Nichol, Barry Philip Nichol, and his work is most easily accessed now. He passed away in 1988. His work is most easily accessed now through Coach House Books and through bpnichol.ca. And basically, he was working from all sorts of forms, from comic books through to visual poetry to long, nine-volume life-writing lyric poems through to small press ephemera and silk screens and paintings, and even wrote songs and plots for children's television shows. So his work is all over the place. He did some of the earliest computer animated poems, and he was a poet that I would strongly recommend any emerging poet kind of goes to, is just spend some time diving around there and start seeing what kind of ideas B.P. Nichol was exploring from about 65 to about 88.
Sure, yeah, I like to look at Nichol's entire catalog as, I like to, when I think of it, I think of it as like surplus futures. Like we can go back into the surplus of work and, you know, use it as like these futures of inspiration, you know? Like there's a lot to go back there to pull from to move into the future, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Every book of his points to a series of strange horizons, right?
Yeah.
You can go that way, or you could go this way. And so, I mean, I would start with somebody like B.P. Nichol, but I would also, you know, just any extra moment you have online, go to UbuWeb and click on something.
Yeah.
Anything. Any link on UbuWeb will open up to something that will just, you know, pop the top of your skull off.
I think the one thing that popped my skull was the shaker poetry, where they have like this seer and someone who's sort of like automatic writing in a trance, and then someone else is drawing the mandalas. You know what I'm talking about?
Some of that work that we would not necessarily consider poetry, we'd see it as something else generally. Once you put it into the setting, it starts vibrating within the history of poetry or the history of the avant-garde in really unusual and exciting ways. Because it's like, okay, how do we write after reading that? Like, what do we do now? And that's why I like Ubu in general, but definitely that work by, Shaker visionaries is pretty amazing too.
Yeah, but you've got some new things coming up and some new things you've been working on. Can you tell us a little bit about your newest project that you've got?
Sure. I actually have, this summer I've had, I have two books coming out. The first one is called Conceptual Arbeiten, and is basically the greatest hits album. It's a collection of my selected visual conceptual work, and that's been published in Switzerland. And the other book, which is coming out in Paris by Jean Boit Editions, is a book called A Novel. It's a 450-page long visual novel that responds to Andy Warhol's novel of the same name. So in 1968, Andy Warhol asked one of the members of his factory, a guy named Robert Oliva, who went by Ondine, to wear a voice-activated microphone over a series of weekends, over a series of years, and record everything he said. Record all the conversations. Those tapes were then given to a bunch of high school students who transcribed them, just straight-ahead transcribed them. And often, you know, they had spelling mistakes. If they couldn't understand the words that they were hearing, they'd make something up. It was rife with strange typos and odd syntactical breaks, and it's this strange, almost stream-of-consciousness novel that Warhol published in 68. And it was published exactly the way the stenographers had typed it down. They didn't edit it. They didn't change it. It was just, boom, there you go. And it's a mess. And it's this very odd, exciting mess that was roundly rejected by critics as just being either pornographic or just, you know, bordering on illiterate. So what I did is, as I'm reading this book, it's a fascinating, fascinating novel, I got really excited by all of the onomatopoeia words, all the sound effect words that occur throughout the book. So you'll get things like you get two characters like walking down the street or in a cab, and you hear the sounds of the New York streets. You'll hear like honk, beep, beep, cabbie yelling, sound of music, as well as all these conversations that are going on. And so as I'm looking at the text, I started, in Photoshop, I deleted all of the words except the punctuation marks. I'm leaving all the punctuation marks up. Adorno actually argued that punctuation marks are the traffic signals of literature. So I'm thinking, like, you're driving up and down the streets of New York. You're actually navigating New York in these on these pages. So I left the traffic signals, and I left the sound effects. So it's basically, it's a sonic portrait of the New York streets in the mid-1960s, as seen in this transcript.
Huh. Wow.
And so now Jean Boite Editions has published this, is publishing this parallel edition, which page by page reissues all the pages in Warhol's novel, removing everything but the automatopoeia words and the punctuation marks.
Wow.
You get these basically star fields of periods and dots and dashes surrounded by the sounds of the New York landscape.
And do you see this as having performative abilities to it?
Well, I'm always inside. I'm very permissive with my work. What I would like people to do is, while I don't always perform it, I'm not a sound poet. I am happy for other people to do it. So one of the things I did do was, as I was making, as I was writing a novel, I released every single page as I wrote it on Twitter. So the entire book is already up. It's already there. And then I invited people, just through, you know, internet announcements and that kind of thing, to respond, interact to any of those pieces in sound. See this as a potential score for performance. And a number of musicians, both Canada, the United States, and in Australia and Europe, responded. And they would take pieces straight out of that, right off the Twitter feed, and set them to music, create some sort of sonic response. So now it's spurred a whole bunch of sound performances that I couldn't even predict, which is all the more exciting, that basically have taken these sound scores and turned them into sound performances.
Very cool. Very cool. When you said that's nice. That's nice that you're permissive and just like allow it to be there for other people to pull and grab from and respond to. I think that's a great way to look at the work, to let it live on and continue on. You said something earlier about leaving, you know, the transcriptions having errors and everything. That reminds me of a story about Dieter Roth doing doing a book that, like, you know, nobody could, like, I guess when he was teaching at one of the schools in the United States, his students really couldn't, like, understand him and, like, had a hard time engaging with him. And they did all this work where they had transcribed a bunch of his work or lectures or something, and it was just completely riddled with errors. And he just decided that they should be left because that the errors told something of the lack of ability in translation, and that they added something of interpretation in the work. So, you know, that's a cool approach, I guess, for him, you know, that he took, you know.
Yeah, I actually think that there's a long history of artists embracing chance and embracing, you know, mistakes and aleatory chance-based kind of decisions, whether it be Cage saying that this score for 433, what we think is a silent score, a silent performance, but actually what it does is it permits all the atmospheric sounds, all the sounds in a music hall to actually come forward, and that is the performance. Or Dieter Roth saying, you know, the mistakes in your transcription are in fact the performance. They're the lecture I didn't know I was giving, right? And I think that's really exciting, to allow the risk and embrace the possibility of response moving in a way that you can't predict and you can't control, and letting that be part of the artwork itself is the permission and welcoming of mistake.
Yeah.
That, you know, somebody might take a risk and say, I want to perform it in this way, and what they perform, you might not like. As if that mattered to you. You know, like, as if that's actually a deciding factor. I would rather people perform it and do something with it that, you know, it's fine, than not perform it at all. Take the risk, see what happens.
Sure. One of the most infamous pop songs of the 60s is riddled with errors, and it's a single recording track, you know, Louie Louie.
is like this song that just like has so many errors in it. The recording is so raw and so rough, but everyone knows that song, you know? Everyone knows it as this sort of like rough, you know, kind of track, and that's what made it so famous.
Yeah, I mean, Louie Louie is so indecipherable and so, so as you said, so riddled with mistakes that I've heard there's all sorts of rumors that, you know, the FBI investigated it to see if it was code.
That's true.
To see if it was some sort of indoctrination. And I'm like, no, it's just a mess. And that's actually really, really exciting that we can actually, the risk and the mess of literature or of art can be so frightening, so disturbing.
That our tax dollars
have the FBI will want to explore it.
Indeed. Well, Derek, thanks so much for the call today. We really appreciate it. We're going to be putting up this episode with a bunch of visual content around the idea of visual poetry, and you've been a great guest today, having given us some of your time. Well, thanks a lot for your time again today, and really appreciate
it. Anytime. I'm glad that we could make it work.
All right, Derek. Thanks so much.
I'll talk to you soon.
Take it easy.
Okay, so we hope you liked that interview. I thought it was really great.
Thought it went well, very well. Not only as a primer, but just really breaking the mind open and reminding us of some things, the way that visual poetry can work, and how it does work, and how I sort of think that the way that Derek was speaking about visual poetry, in a certain sense, it makes it more accessible to the public.
But I think that's a funny thing about visual poetry, right? I think he was right on in saying that the thing that makes it inaccessible is calling it visual poetry in a way. If it appeared without you knowing what it was,
sure,
it would probably be readily understandable.
It's being at play, right? And Derek talks about how visual poetry, about how there's a safety in poetry, in lyric, and in putting it in a book, and how a lot of poets just sort of stay within the constraint of the page. But that visual poetry begs to be taken off of the page and to be put into the environment, to be put on buttons or t-shirts or whatever else, you know, is like this visual design thing. And that advertisement and design and those things that come through in the sort of the graphic presentation that we all experience on a daily basis kind of frames us, or it sort of, what did he say? How did he put it? It prepares us for a different language that we can inhabit in the visual poetry world.
Well, yeah, and I think in visual poetry, if you think of it in a historical standpoint, it's always been about escaping constraints in some way, right? I don't know if that's, I mean, I think we can find examples that are earlier than that, but I think of like Dada and Surrealism and Futurism as really being one of the big flourishing places of visual poetry early on. And that's what it was all about, was taking things out of context and making that into poetry, right? Taking things that weren't poetry and using those tools and using those things and mixing it all together.
Yeah, the Dada's really what they did with collage work and taking newspaper content and breaking it up and bringing it in. And it was really like they were playing. One of the things that people don't talk about that is that they were really playing with the technology of the time
and
photo typesetting and like looking at things of taking the cut-ups and bringing them together and creating them in a new way to like kind of really crack the mind open and take it out of that formal approach of the columns of the newspaper, which was the media of the day, and breaking it up and putting things on slants and bringing it in different directions and looping it around and having it eat itself.
And I mean, you mentioned there's certainly people who did that before. Like you mentioned Apollinaire. When you think about visual poetry, how do you not think about Apollinaire? And that's pre that.
Yeah.
But it's not a coincidence that surrealists thought of him as a saint of some kind, right? Because he prefigured a lot of those things in ways. But yeah, you think of those calligrams, and yeah, there were other people doing poetry that was shape-based, but a lot of them were very literal, trying to make them the shapes of the things they were talking about. And there's some of Apollinaire's stuff that does that, but I really always liked the ones that were more abstract. And I think that's another thing about visual poetry, is there's always some element of abstraction, right? Language is already an abstraction, but we forget that it's an abstraction, right? And that's one of the nice things about visual poetry to me, is that it calls attention to the fact that you're dealing with this abstraction every moment of the day, essentially, but you just don't think about it all
sure.
the time.
Sure, yeah. When you're presented with language or a word or a thing that's trying to get you to respond, advertisement and the way, you know, I don't think you can, honestly, I don't think you can open up a single mass market magazine and not see visual poetry in it. It's just there. It's used all the time. It's used in a certain way to elicit a response, or a lot of times an emotional response or an action, you know, logos and all that stuff and the way that words.
Well, when it's done well, it's visual poetry, right?
Right.
When it's not done well, I don't know, maybe sometimes it still is on accident, but most of the time, I would say, I don't know, a lot of advertisement is strangely tone deaf at what it's even trying to do. But yes, when it's done well and it works.
Sure.
Well, and I guess that's something that's interesting. The overlap is on purpose, because part of what visual poetry is doing is using whatever tools are available. But there is this, especially when you think of graphic design and typography, there's a lot of overlap with that and visual poetry.
For sure. Well, it's the way that language is presented in a non-linear fashion, and how it's, you know, here's our T, but it's joining in the bottom out of the Q, or, you know, like even just the way the typography is treated as an object.
Yeah. What do you think is the difference then between, or is there one, maybe you're going to say there's not one, between good graphic design and visual poetry?
That's a good point. I think as a designer, I would say that I want to bring in a little bit of visual poetry in everything that I do. But that if I'm really pushing it really hard, there's more visual poetry and less design. I don't know if that's, because it's all design, sort of, but I guess it depends on the outcome, the interest, the outcome of what the person wants, you know, what the final outcome wants. But
well, there's this real delineation in visual poetry, it seems like, that you have some visual poets where you still have clearly readable poetry that's just presented in an interesting fashion. And then you have some where it seems like the whole point is for there to be no comprehensible content that you can get out of it. Well, at least not language-wise. I mean, there's certainly content there, but it's not coming from the language. It's coming from the other elements that are going on.
Well, this is not answering your initial question, but I'm going to address the last thing you said, which is that some visual poetry is this abstract presentation, but there's still a readable thing going on. Even Apollinaire's calligrams do that. You can still read them, and yes, they form an object or a thing, but you can still read them, right? That's the whole point, is that you can still read them. It's not this complete abstraction. Personally, I like to hover in that space between the abstraction and readability, where, you know, I have a piece that you can read it from four different directions, and it might have four different meanings, you know? But I do think that within any art form or within any genre like poetry, if you look at visual poetry, there is different ends of the spectrum.
I almost tend to gravitate towards visual poetry that does not have comprehensible content. I tend to like it better because I feel like a lot of times visual poets who are working with content that are comprehensible tend to let their content be really cliche and shitty because they feel like the visual element is carrying the weight of the piece in a way that doesn't always work for me, where I feel like the people who are dealing with the less content are more attentive to what they're doing on the visual level. But then what is making it poetry and not just graphic design, which I guess is the question I originally asked you. And, you know, I was looking at some of Derek's work, and I was like, why do I like this and not like some other visual poets' works that are doing similar things? And I think any of the people who I like, there's this element of the visual aspect of whatever they're doing that creates a rhythm, right? And it's really, if you can translate rhythm into a visual sense, in some way, there's a myriad of ways to do that, right? But that works very well, right? And I think that's a lot of what it's doing. What is poetry if it's not rhythm? If it's not about... And I don't know. And, like, he brought up sound poetry, and I was thinking about it, too. And I was like, why are there so many visual poets that are also sound poets? And that's not a coincidence, right? There's this being in touch with the fact that poetry isn't really about language. You're using language as a tool to do it. It's about rhythm. Whether it's percussive or whether it's just value rhythm, it's just this repetition and lack of repetition. And the variation of those things is really what it's coming down to on some level.
I think it depends on the style and the approach of the specific poets, you know, visual poetry.
But then, I don't know, I guess good graphic design is rhythmic too.
It is. Because it balances the white space and usage of space.
So I don't know if that really answers my own question. But I don't know. And then I find myself sometimes, like, I was looking through some visual poetry in preparation for this. And I saw a lot of great stuff that I really loved. But then I saw a lot of stuff that I didn't like too. And I think it's funny, and it kind of relates to what Derek was talking about with putting this category on a visual poetry. I found myself kind of angry at the things that I didn't like. And I don't know why. And then I caught myself because I'm like, you know, if I was reading a regular poetry journal, I'd hate 90% of it too. Why am I more angry at this? And it's because of the context thing about it. It's very strange because it's a different context than you're used to. Even if it's something you are aware of, and there's this strange reaction that it makes you have, right? But that's by design. That's part of what visual poetry has always been about, is it's been this kind of promotion of taking things out of context, this promotion of eliminating that aspect of it. And I think that's a lot of the value of it, especially in the poetry world where things can be over-conventionalized. That's one of the wonderful things about visual poetry, is that it's fighting against that. It's fighting against this sort of boxing in that can happen with poetry.
Well, I just think it's all back to I think it all comes back to the intent of the author and the intent of the maker and where they are. Do they approach it from a poetry perspective? Are they approaching from a visual art perspective? Are they a visual artist writing visual poetry? Are they a poet creating visual work? It's almost like you need to know a little bit of the intent behind.
Well, I think that's bullshit. I don't think you ever need to know the intent about anything. If you need to know the intent, it's shitty art. The only way it's any good is if you don't need to know the intent, right? They can have that intent all they want. For art to be good, it has to have its effect regardless of intent. You don't get to know the author's intent, right? You don't get to know the artist's intent. You don't get to know that. And even if you do, that shouldn't be affecting your experience of it.
Okay, I buy it.
And I don't know. I think any good visual poetry I've seen, you're right, there's all kinds of different styles. That's certainly true. And I think people do have different intents. But I think all of it that works embraces the garbling aspect of it, right? That it's garbling the language on some level. Which is, I think, related to this kind of rebellious tendency of it, right? Which is a good part of it. Where so much of poetry is about meaning, which is the worst part of poetry in a way, right? It's the stereotypical mawkish part of poetry, that it's about meaning. Any visual poetry that I think works on some level garbles the meaning or erases the meaning in some way, fights against that.
I like when it makes it indeterminate. Well, I like when it makes it
But that's garbling, right? I'm not saying it doesn't always have to erase it completely, but it garbles it in some way, right? It escapes that idea of poetry being about meaning. Which I don't think poetry should be about meaning.
Well, it's indeterminate. Meaning.
Yeah, but that's fine. But then the meaning is not coming from the poetry anymore, and that's fine. It's coming from the audience's head.
Right. That, I do agree that that is where the best, where the most successful visual poetry hovers, in that space.
When I was looking at Ubu Web, which I don't think I ever even knew about this project, one of the things I thought was interesting was I found that Rosemary Waldrop, do you know this?
Maybe.
The camp printing?
Hmm. I don't know about this.
And she took poems by this guy, James Camp. And I guess this was like when the Waldrops were doing a lot of printing for other poets. And I think it just came about because she made a mistake when she was doing the printing or something at some point. And so it was just printing multiple lines on top of itself, on top of itself. And it comes out, look, here's a little element of it you can kind of see on this page. So there's these things like this that are just kind of like these shapes where you can't see much of the text at all anymore, or maybe a little bit of it. But
is that typewriter poetry?
It's not. It's printing. It's not typewriter, but it's just printing on top of printing on top of printing, right? I think there's a little more on the other side, too. Some you can read a little bit of it through, but a lot of it you can't.
Right.
But I liked in that interview, because there was the one part that I found, that she talks about, you know, she says, the last page of the book, it says the poems were made by James Camp. And she says that by saying that is placing them in the past, admitting that I killed the voice of the poems by treating them as mere visual artifacts. And I feel like there's always this element of that in visual poetry of killing the poems, right? Maybe not totally, or garbling it at least, if you're not totally killing it. But there is this aspect of frustration with the inability of language to do what you want it to do. And just be like, I'm going to use these other tools and make it do more than it's capable of doing, right? Or make you have to do the work. Make you as a reader. Part of it's, I think, frustration with the reader, too. Like, like readers, you're too lazy. I'm going to make you do this work and because you're not doing it when I just give you this thing on the page.
I remember trying to do some visual poetry in, like, undergrad creative writing class at UMass. And I'm not going to say that I did it really well. But I remember getting shut down by my teacher, like, just had no idea how to interpret it, had no idea where it was going, and did not buy the argument of it being indeterminate, you know, and it being an open interpretation. And there were, like, a couple students in the class who just thought it was so cool, you know, just, like, probably, like, visual artists from Hampshire College or, you know, some girl from Smith
line.
Or something.
I think it is a fine line, though, right, because it is fair sometimes. I mean, there's certainly some people trying to do visual poetry where you're like, this is bullshit, right? Because it isn't just about it being open to interpretation. There is that there, but you have to create that interpretation, right? The same way as anything, as any kind of art form, right? You can't just, you know, just because you're doing visual art, you can't just slap anything on a painting and be like, it's up to your interpretation. You have to lead the audience in a direction first. Part of it can be open to their interpretation. And I don't know what you were doing. I'm not saying you weren't doing that. But I think that's the place where visual poetry has to rest, right? There needs to be enough given to lead the audience in a direction, I think. But I do think the hostility that you said that you got in when you presented that in a workshop is not uncommon, right? I think a lot of poets, especially that are more establishment poets, have a lot of hostility towards visual poetry. But I think part of it is context again. And I do like what Derek was saying about putting it in, not presenting it in a book all the time. Because I think that probably generates more hostility, seeing it on the page, than seeing it in other contexts. I think people are more ready to accept it and just take it as what it is.
The hostility that I see is like people who can't really ebb out into that world of indeterminacy, and poets who are maybe more kept poets, who I like to, you know, sort of phrase, you know, say this sort of kept poets. And but Derek was right about like it being safe. You know, he's like, oh, you know, poetry is, you know, poetry, the safe poetry is in the book on the shelf, and that's just where it's going to live, and that's just how it goes. And, you know, maybe something that's a little more dangerous is stepping out into a different world. Into,
I don't know, it's funny. I was, it kind of relates to something totally unrelated that I was reading today. I was reading this article in the New Yorker about this company that was trying to make sensory input devices for people who had lost a sense, a sensation, right?
Whoa.
And I mean, I guess like the main story they were talking about was this guy who was, he had lost his sight when he was very young, but he was a mountain climber. He climbed mountains and he's been doing it without sight. But now he's using this device they made where he puts this thing on his tongue and it, there's a camera on his head and it interprets the pixels from the camera into sensations on his tongue. And so he can get, like, a rough visual from that, and it helps him with the mountain climbing.
Whoa.
But where does this relate to this? You know, then they were talking to this doctor and his theories about that, and he said, well, the thing we forget about all the time is that writing is a sensory input device. We're taking something that was initially auditory and creating a different way of inputting and turning it into a visual input, right? You know, I think we think of our senses as separate, and I think we think of our thinking and our sight and our feeling and our hearing as all separate. And visual poetry, what I like is it calls attention to the fact that you're really always synthesizing all of those things, right? And how we're using that to build meaning isn't really just through one thing or another. And I don't know, I guess what you get a lot of argument in poetry. Is it about being read or is it about being heard? Is it about performance or is it about seeing it on the page? And visual poetry kind of brings all of that. It makes it very obvious that none of those things is true, that you have to be doing all of those things on some level, right? That it is this coalescence of all those different elements of what language is. And that there is, it's a complicated, abstracted thing. It's not one thing, right?
And it's some not.
And if we're going to talk about where the boundaries of poetry are.
True.
And that's probably the most interesting parts of poetry, the stuff that's on the boundaries.
And there may be a new interpretation of visual poetry for every single visual poet there is.
Well, maybe. I don't know. There's a gradient there, I suppose.
There is a gradient. Well, let's take you out here with some of the work that's been created around Derek's latest novel that's coming out this summer.
All right, so this is the link that he sent.
Yep.
From...
Yep, we're gonna take you out with some sound work.
All right, here we go.